they can.
Do you find people want to just move in a little bit? I wanted to make it intimate, but let's just make sure that everybody can see. Ladies and gentlemen, one is always nice to speakers who come to Pardes, but today I really feel that we're inviting a personal friend and a friend of Pardes, Yossi Klein Halevi. I'm really, really happy that you're with us. It's an honor to have you. Yossi's just come from a very heavy, how long were you in the States? For 6 months?
Too long, yeah.
6 months, where he really was the star of the show wherever he was, and it's really, really wonderful to have you with us today. At the end of today, you can buy books, and I'm sure Yossi will be very happy to autograph them. But you never know, Candace may agree to autograph it as well. Candace was one of the interns for Yossi's latest book, and I've asked Candace to introduce Yossi Klein Halevi.
It's my pleasure to introduce Yossi Klein Halevi. I had, like Duncan said, the joy and honor of working with Yossi 2 summers ago at the Hartman Institute on his most recent book, Like Dreamers, which I'm sure he'll speak about in detail, but if you don't know, it's a story that follows the story of 7 paratroopers from the Six-Day War into the present day. And he'll speak about it, but from my personal experience reading it and from other people who've read it, it's really a magnificent, powerful, and brilliant book that beautifully written and I think is really essential to understanding Israel today and the current political landscape. And I really encourage you all to pick up a copy on your way out, and I hope you all will read it. Besides that, Yossi's life is really fascinating, but I was told not to speak about it because Yoke will be asking him all sorts of questions about his personal life story, so you'll hear it straight from Yossi. From my experience at Hartman working with Yossi until today, he's really inspired and influenced me in many ways, and Yossi's really a Jewish thinker, leader, and writer that I really look up to. So I'm so excited that he's here today, and it's thank a you. Really wonderful learning opportunity for all of us.
Great. Candace, thank you.
Today's a conversation, people, between Yossi and me. I hope it will bring people from Pardes into it as well. I'm going to be asking Yossi some questions. He may throw back some questions at me. To start off with, as Candace said, I think it would be nice if the people here learned a little bit about your life before actually looking at your latest book. There have actually been 4 different works which in some way deal with you or that you've written about. One was a movie called Kaddish, which deals with your relationship with your father, who was a Holocaust survivor, which the Village Voice called one of the 10 best movies of that year. You wrote a book called Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist, which speaks about your time in the Kach youth movement, Entering the Garden of Eden, which is about interfaith work, and your latest book, Like Dreamers, about the soldiers in the Six-Day War. Would you like to maybe just tell us a little bit about your life, highlighting these different works, what made you write them, and how they fit into your own biography?
Okay, well, first of all, hi, everybody. just David going through this, it sounds pretty schizophrenic. You know, a Kach interfaith activist. just to unpack that a little bit, I would start really where you did with Kaddish, which is about my background as a son of a survivor from Hungary. And the film is called Kaddish because it's really about the death of my father. We began filming about a year before my father died in 1977. And we didn't, of course, know that that's what would happen. And then the film really became about the death of a survivor and then how a family copes with the end of that legacy. In a way, it's about the something that we're all going through now generationally, but which I experienced prematurely, which is the definitive end of the Holocaust generation. So that's really what that film is about, and that's a useful ground for explaining my first book, Memoirs of a Jewish Extremist, which is about the years that I spent as first as an activist growing up in the more normative Soviet Jewry movement, and then making the shift toward Meir Kahana. This was the late 60s, early 70s. It was not yet Kach. I think it's an important distinction, although maybe only important to those of us who lived it. Because when Meir Kahana was active in the U.S. in the late 60s and especially early 70s, he drew a lot of young people like myself who saw him as the expression of or the Jewish equivalent of the American 60s. And Kahana very brilliantly played on that. He borrowed the rhetoric of what was known then as the New Left and of the Black Panthers, and he appropriated that kind of militant language and adapted it to the Jewish experience, and he managed to present himself as a as the Jewish expression of the radical 60s. And I had friends who made that crossover from SDS, which was the radical New Left organization at the time, to what became the radical right, although Kahana didn't quite let on in those years that his final stop would be the radical right. He was still in some way fudging it. And the main focus of Kahana in those years, in the years that I joined him, was the Soviet Jewry movement, liberating Soviet Jewry. He hadn't yet emerged as the farthest of the Jewish right wing. And what I would unequivocally call the racist far Jewish far right. That really happened when he moved to Israel in the early 70s. So my next stop in this bibliography is the journey that I took in the late 1990s into Islam and Christianity. And obviously there's a big gap. How did I get from the early 70s with Kahana to going into Islam and Christianity in this land? And that's the journey that I took and then eventually wrote about, was as a religious Jew going into Islam and Christianity in Israel and the territories, even in a Sufi mosque in a Gaza refugee camp. And it's inconceivable today to imagine that one could show up in a kippah and in a Sufi mosque in Nusrat. But in the late 90s, there was a small window of opening. And I would just say very, in the most shorthand possible, that the key transition for me from being an angry young man, child of survivors, to an interfaith activist, really happened through Israel and Zionism. It happened through becoming an Israeli. I moved to Israel in 1982. And what I realized in making that transition from diaspora Jew to Israeli is something that will come as no surprise to all of you growing up when you did. But for my generation of American Jews growing up with a kind of idealized notion of Israel and really feeling ourselves to be victims, and trying to work through that state of extreme victimization, coming to Israel was very liberating for me. The fact that we had our own moral problems was actually a wonderful experience for me, because it freed me from this burden of victimization. And I think that Zionism's hard gift to the Jewish people, it was certainly its gift to me, but the hard gift of Zionism was that we're going to take responsibility for our lives, for our collective lives, and that we're not going to be helpless Jews anymore with all the anger of our history, but it's time for us to start joining the real world and looking at ourselves and seeing how we do in the real world. So for me, that was very liberating. And it was liberating in the sense that it meant I didn't have to carry that identity of victim anymore. And I think that really is what Zionism has done for the Jewish people as a whole. So, and the last book, which you mentioned, David, the one that I just recently published and which Candace worked with me on. I was listening very carefully to see how you would sum up the book, Candace. Did good. So that book was really, in a way, my coming of age as an Israeli. I spent more than 10 years working on that book, and from the beginning of the Second Intifada, more or less, till a year ago, and that was an attempt to, in a sense, come full circle and try to understand what happened to us as a result, what happened to us as a people as a result of the Six-Day War. The first time I came to Israel was the summer of 67. And this book was a way of looking at seven Israeli paratroopers who had fought in Jerusalem in 1967. And one part of this group went on to become leaders of the settlement movement, and another part went on to become leaders of the peace movement. And through these seven lives, in a way trying to understand my own life and the trajectory that all of us are still on. Long answer.
Thank you very much. Maybe we'll start with the last book and move backwards. You said that the book was very much working out things about your own life. Do you want to just give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of these seven, and then maybe tell you which one you most identify with and which one you least identify with?
Ooh, well.
We ask hard questions.
Let's see. Well, on the right, the three paratroopers that I focus on are probably the best known, or at least had the most impact directly on the history of Israel, because these three men became, in effect, the architects of the settlement movement, beginning with Hanan Porat, who founded the first settlement in September 67, Kfar Etzion, kibbutz in Gush Etzion. It's a whole story. You should visit there, and it's really a significant place. Yisrael Harel, who founded the Yesha Council, which is the umbrella organization of the settlements, and really brought the settlement movement from the hilltops into the establishment. He's the one who was the architect for that. And Yoel Ben Nun, who was in some ways the most interesting theologian of the settlement movement, and then after the Rabin assassination broke with the settlement movement and became the great heretic of the right, and is, to my mind, I'll just answer the last part of your question, is the hero of the book. And I see him as certainly the character I most identify with, because he went through the most far-reaching personal changes. And in some ways, I see a certain American equivalent of my own Jewish journey with his, moving from the hard right to the center. So that's no question that Yoel Ben Nun is the hero of the book. There are one or two other heroes, and they come from the kibbutz side of the story. And I should mention, by the way, that it's not just about left and right. It's about religious Zionists and kibbutzniks, or settlers and kibbutzniks. All of the left-wingers, the peace activists that I focus on in the book, are all kibbutzniks, and that was a deliberate choice, because the book is really about the utopian dreams of Israel. And I wanted the messianic, the secular messianists of the kibbutz movement, who shaped Israeli identity in the early decades of the state, and then shifting to the religious messianists of the settlement movement, who shaped the state in its later decades. And among the kibbutzniks, there is Arik Achmon, who was the chief intelligence officer of the paratrooper brigade that fought in Jerusalem in 1967. Arik is the guy who planned the war, in effect. And then in 1973, in the Yom Kippur War — we've recently observed the 40th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War — And the paratroopers, the same guys who I write about from 67, were the ones who crossed the canal in 1973 on the night of October 16th and basically turned the war against the Egyptians and ended up winning the Yom Kippur War for Israel, turning defeat into victory. So they're an astonishing group of men. Arik Achmon led the crossing across the canal and planned that crossing. And then as a civilian, he shifted from kibbutznik, he left the kibbutz, and became actually one of the founding fathers of Israeli capitalism. It's one of the great ironies in the book. And in fact, he's married to the daughter of the legendary leader of the kibbutz movement, Yaakov Chazan. And he comes from kibbutz aristocracy. He is as deeply rooted in socialist Israel as you can be. And he became a turncoat. He became the economic equivalent of Yoel Ben-Nun. And he's my other hero in the book. And I'd say for the same reason, because he made such a radical shift in his own consciousness. And he is the father of high-tech, to my mind, he's the father of high-tech Israel, or one of the fathers. He made Startup Nation possible by taking us out of a dysfunctional economic model that worked very well when we were a small agrarian pioneering entity. And as soon as we became a state, worked less and less well. And Arik is the guy who organized the first privatization of a government company. It was Arkia, the domestic airline. And he just recently turned 80. And of all the people in the book, he is actually my closest friend. He's the person that I've developed the strongest relationship with. And it's a very improbable friendship because Arik is a technocrat. I've never been friends with anybody like him before. He's the most infuriatingly, relentlessly pragmatic person that I know. He refuses to call himself a dreamer. And yet he's the person that I, for whatever reason, have developed the strongest connection with. Meir Ariel, also one of my favorite characters in the book. If people know the name Meir Ariel, write down the name, please. And go into YouTube and start listening to his music. Because Meir is our Bob Dylan. Or as my son Gabriel said, when I said to him that I think Meir is our Bob Dylan, he said, Shtuyot, Meir is greater than Dylan. So take that for what it's worth. Israelis feel very, very passionately about Meir Ariel. He died in 1999 before I had a chance to get... Could you guys move here? I'm sorry, I have my back to you, and I'd like to include you. Thank you. Meir died in 1999 and posthumously has become the most beloved singer probably after Arik Einstein. Maybe Meir Ariel and Arik Einstein are the two iconic figures of contemporary modern Israeli music. And Meir is the great poet balladeer of Israeliness. And his journey from bohemian wise guy to religious Jew is also one of the transitional stories that this book tells. You're going to have to stop me at a certain point because I can really just go on and on. There's Avital Geva, who was one of the founders of Peace Now and one of Israel's leading conceptual artists, left the art world because it was all ego as far as he was concerned, and devoted himself to education, coexistence work, an extraordinary, extraordinary guy. The other person in the book who I'm closest to, personally. And then there's Udi Adiv, Acharon Chaviv. Someone translate that. And,
I'm not sure if you're being sarcastic or not, because I think that's the one you have the most trouble
with. Well, Udi is a story. they're all stories, but Udi is really a story. Kibbutznik from Gan Shmuel, one of the seminal Shomer HaTzair kibbutzim. A paratrooper, as like the others, fought in Jerusalem in 67, like the others. After the Six-Day War, became radical anti-Zionist. And in 1972, traveled to Damascus to try to create an anti-Zionist terrorist underground. Was arrested on his return, spent 12 years in an Israeli prison. And when I mentioned to Israelis of my generation that Udi Adiv is one of the characters in my book, they can't believe it. People forget that Udi was a paratrooper. So Udi represents, of course, the far left in this story, that part of, I'd say, the Israeli elite, and by extension, that part of the of diaspora Jewry that has fallen out of love with the Zionist story and that has exchanged the Palestinian narrative for the Zionist narrative. And Udi is an extreme example of that phenomenon, but I'm very glad that he's part of this story.
Where's Uri today?
He is teaching at the Open University in Haifa. And he was very cooperative with the book. He was he didn't like the book. He's that I can tell you. And but he was very cooperative in helping me do it.
You end the book in 2004, and I'm interested. I mean, I had to stop somewhere, I guess. But
I
mean,
I did have to stop somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, you could maybe create a website. Where are they now, or something like that?
I think Candace, when you were working with me, I didn't know where I was going to end, and the book was something like 1,000 pages, and miraculously, I got it down to about to a little under 600. And yes, the book did have to end somewhere. So that's
that
is part of the answer.
Yeah.
But there's a literary answer and there's an historical answer. The literary answer is that I really liked all of my characters at that moment, and as I felt that in some way they had all reached their peak at that point, and several of them went into a kind of decline afterwards, and I couldn't bear tracing that. I wanted to leave each of them at a certain high point in their development, in their personal lives. And historically, 2004 is a very significant moment in this country. It's the moment, first of all, when the Second Intifada was defeated, when we won the Second Intifada. It's the moment when a very strong center, and we should talk, maybe we can talk more about this, when a majority of Israelis became centrists, which is to say that most of the left came to realize that the Oslo process had been an illusion. And most of the moderate right, let's say not the settlers, but the Likud voters, had come to realize that Greater Israel had also been a fantasy. And a majority of Israelis by 2004 had come to the conclusion that the occupation is a disaster for Israel, but that we tried to end it in the year 2000. And it was that the blame was now shifted to the Palestinian leadership. That's the narrative which the overwhelming majority of Israelis believed, and I would say to some extent still do believe, and I'm certainly part of that consensus. And if you don't read Haaretz or Makor Rishon, which is the settlers' magazine newspaper, the more or less center consensus that emerges, which is that a Palestinian state is both an existential necessity for Israel and an existential threat to Israel, that's where most Israelis are at today. And so by 2004, that centrist majority had emerged. And that came through several of the characters. Yoel Ben-Nun had by then given up his dream of Greater Israel and moved to the center and actually supported Kadima at that time. And Avital Geva, one of the founders of Peace Now, had decided that that the Palestinian national movement is incapable of coming to terms with the legitimacy of the Jewish national movement, and that we need to find another way because there will not be a negotiated two-state solution. That's where unilateral withdrawal came in as an option. So 2004 is also a moment before the unilateral withdrawal from Gaza. And everybody knows where the story is going, and I wanted to end before the withdrawal from Gaza.
We're actually a family who read both Haaretz and Makor Rishon. So I don't, there aren't that many of them, but we subscribe
and you all
to
read, them. And you read both of them?
Actually, we read both of them.
Or one, your spouse reads one.
No, we all read them all, but we actually don't read the middle ones. So I don't, maybe we'll ask you that question at the end when we talk about extremists.
That's actually what I did when I first came to Israel. Yeah. I tried to educate myself about what the nature of this place was by reading at that time the equivalent was Nikuda, which was the settler magazine, and Koteret Rashid, which was the left-wing magazine.
We were just reminiscing, Yossi and I, we both, although Yossi is a bit older than me, we both came to Israel at similar times. Do you remember how many more newspapers there were in those days?
Amazing.
Every brand of left-wing Lewingerism had its own newspaper, like every slight shade of socialism had its own.
Plus, there was a Hungarian newspaper.
I remember that. And that actually brings us to my next question that I have. I don't want to put words into your mouth. I do that enough with my students. But it seems to me as if, for you, the Israeli center has become the new utopia after the failures of different utopias. I'm interested if you can speak a little bit in your life and your work about the animating force of utopias. As I was preparing the questions, I was actually going through old boxes, and I found this magazine, which is the 10th anniversary of Response. It was a countercultural magazine from the 1960s, that countercultural Jewish magazine from the 1960s, and already in 1976, on their 10th anniversary edition, was about Have We Sold Out? Mm-hmm. That was already in 76. So I'm interested in hearing from you. This is a country that was found on utopias, lots of different utopias, how it's animated you in your life, what you've seen in your work, and again, maybe what you think about my statement about you, that for you the center seems to have become the new, if not utopia, but the new sort of ideal or goal.
Right. Well, the utopian temptation or longing is really at the heart of this book, and the book is called Like Dreamers, which comes from Tehillim. It comes from Shir HaMa'alot. It's what we can sing. Oh, I'm fine, thanks. Yeah. It's what we sing on Shabbat. Hayinu Kechomim, and I took that because I felt that the unspoken central narrative of this country is really a clash of utopian dreams. It's a clash of what left and right are not just arguing about different political visions, but much more profoundly about different conceptions of Israel's place in the world, and how will Israel help bring us from an unredeemed world to a redeemed world. I think that was the animating force of the early kibbutz movement. The kibbutz movement really believed that the world was about to be transformed into through communism, and the early kibbutzniks were very much communists, democratic communists. One has to emphasize that. They were not Bolsheviks in that sense. But they saw the kibbutzim here as being the in a way a microcosm of what was happening in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was communism for the masses, and it was necessarily messy, and the kibbutz movement was the more purist form of communism, and therefore more democratic and more elitist. But very much Zionism owes its existence to this utopian dream. One can say fantasy, but certainly the Zionism itself was a utopian fantasy. The notion of coming back here after 2,000 years is on some level absurd. And it worked, but that's the part of the utopian fantasy that, of course, was fulfilled. So the subsidiary fantasies have failed. So the utopian fantasy of kibbutz, which then began to falter, bless you, after 67, began to decline, and in its place began to rise a competing utopian fantasy, which was that the wholeness of the land of Israel, by restoring the wholeness of the Holy Land, a cosmic rupture would be healed. It was very, there's Kabbalah in the background of this very practical political settlement movement. The notion that the redemption would be quickened through restoring the wholeness of the land of Israel. And so you had these utopian movements shaping Israeli politics, Israeli society. And just as a writer, this notion fascinated me, that we are a utopian experiment. We are living out these extraordinary dreams of very determined practical political activists. But that's really in some sense what the history of Israel is. Now, as a religious person, I'm fascinated by this. As an Israeli citizen who has to live with the consequences of repeated failed utopian ideas, I'm personally very frustrated by the impact of the utopian conceit on our small lives here. And I see one of the difficult aspects of Israel is how do we navigate between the necessary longing for a redeemed world, which is at the heart of Jewish people. And if we don't have that longing for a redeemed world, then something essential in our makeup becomes lost. And I don't think we will be the Jewish people anymore. On the other hand, how do we stop repeatedly finding ourselves caught up in the middle of political utopian disasters? And if you think about communism for a moment, now the kibbutz movement was, as I say, a very benign form of communism. And yet, as a people, we were heavily implicated in some of the less benign expressions of communism as they played out in the 20th century. And that's something we have not yet come to terms with. I would call it the poisonous side of the Jewish longing for tikkun olam. And I think we really need to come to terms with that as a people. There's a reckoning that we need to do with ourselves that we have avoided. We're still, as a people, very sentimental about the Jewish communists of the 20s and 30s, and we have not taken responsibility for Stalinism, for example. Not that we didn't create Stalinism, but we're not entirely innocent from that period of history. And that's what the left has to carry. And the right, of course, has its own burden to carry, and we're playing that out now. And so utopianism, when it's linked with politics, at the very least leads to disappointment. And very often much worse than disappointment. My hope is that we are beginning, and this brings us to your question, David, about the center. My hope is that a more mature Israeli society is beginning to neutralize or separate the utopian dream from practical politics. And Israel today, Israeli politics, is I would say, virtually free from utopianism, even if you look at Habayit HaYudi, look at the pro-settler political party, they don't talk about messianism anymore the way they did in the 70s and the 80s. The settlers today are talking very practical politics. They're talking about the consequences for Israel politically, security, in terms of security, of a Palestinian state. They're much more in an apocalyptic mode than they are in a messianic mode today. And so the whole conversation, the whole political conversation in Israel has shifted from the utopianism of the 70s and 80s, which was a right-wing utopianism, to the 90s, which was the resurrection of left-wing utopianism during the Oslo years. And I can tell you, as somebody who lived through the Oslo years here and who was initially a supporter of the Oslo process and covered it as a journalist, that we deluded ourselves in another utopian fantasy. We turned Arafat into a kind of redeemer. And we paid the price for that in the year 2000. And so we are in a kind of prolonged hangover in Israeli society today from the successive failures of our utopian dreams. And that partly explains a certain depression in Israeli society today, as well as I think the fact that we are in prolonged post-traumatic stress from the Second Intifada and everything that happened since. And I think that's a generational phenomenon. And at the same time, we're starting to look at our situation with clarity. When you take away the utopian political fantasy and you just look at Israel's dilemma in the Middle East, it's very hard to be left-wing or right-wing. And most Israelis today are neither, or a little bit of both. And so I see the center as being the place that not the place that's going to make peace. I think we need to just wipe out the word peace from our political vocabulary and think about more practical solutions, like how do we free ourselves from the occupation without taking existential risks. That's what this next phase is going to be about for Israel. And peace is something most Israelis don't talk about anymore. Neither do we talk about Greater Israel. And so that is really, I think, an expression of a hard-won maturity in Israel. And at the same time, it opens the question, which is what I raised a moment ago, which is, can we be true to ourselves without a utopian dream? And then the question is, where does the utopian dream come from? What will be the next? And I believe another utopian movement is coming here, but my sense is it's going to be much more inward directed. It will not be political. It will be hopefully spiritual. It will be about who are we and why are we here? Why did we come home? And what should Judaism look like in a sovereign Jewish state? Those are questions that we have not really begun to ask ourselves. I think maybe we're starting to ask ourselves those questions now. And I think it's a really interesting period that's coming up, and not coincidentally related to the collapse of the political utopian movements, which were kind of substitute religious movements.
I'm reminded a bit of Karl Popper, who said, when people try to build heaven on earth, they usually end up with hell.
I don't think we ended up. We didn't end up with hell.
Yeah, but
but there is something there.
But I wanted to push you on something that's a little bit like hell. Just in the statement you made about the communism, as a white South African Jewish Israeli male, I'm used to being responsible for every bad thing on the universe. I mean, there's nothing bad that I'm not actually responsible for. But I just want to push back a little bit. And you said that the Jews, we as a people, have not really come to terms with the havoc that communism wrought and how Jews were involved in it. I just want to push back. I think, to my mind, those were Jews as individuals, very, very often very separate from the Jewish community. I think it's a hard, I mean, I'm just pushing back, but I think it's a hard call to say that we as a people actually have to do a reckoning and see many other things that we have to do a communal reckoning as Jewish people for our involvement in. This one strikes me as a little too much.
Well, I think you're right that that the Jewish communists were in a sense renegades. I mean, they broke away from the Jewish people. But I detect within the Jewish left today a certain softness, a certain nostalgia almost for the Jews who fought in the Lincoln Brigade in Spain, the communists, the American communists. Who there's something there that I still feel is there's a warning there for us about Jewish naivete that we haven't confronted, and my book does deal with that, and one of the characters. One of one of my closest friends from the seven, Avital Geva, the artist who became an educator and a coexistence activist, one of the founders of Peace Now. The most dramatic part of his story is he's wounded in the Six-Day War, and he comes back to his kibbutz, a very left, a very Marxist kibbutz, which had been passionately pro-Soviet. And in fact, had been Stalin, pro-Stalin in the 50s. And when Stalin died, they mourned on his kibbutz. Stalin died on Purim. Think about that. Stalin died on Purim. And on HaShomer HaTzair kibbutzim, that wasn't seen as a miracle. It was seen as a tragedy. The leader of the revolution has been taken from us. And you have to see the newspapers, the Israeli newspapers of the left of that time, the huge pictures of Stalin, the grief. And so after Avital is wounded in the Six-Day War, he comes back to his kibbutz and he says, you know, your Soviet Union armed the Arabs who killed my friends. And there's this deep rage, a generational, a revolt of the younger generation of kibbutzniks against their pro-Soviet parents. And it's a wonderful moment, but it doesn't only belong there. I think it's part of a wider Jewish story that needs to be told. And look, you know, whenever when we talk about what a wonderful people we are, and how you know, the Jew, how committed we are to social justice. Well, I think we need to factor in the Marxists of the 20th century, and say, well, let's look at that as part of our Tikkun Olam story. That's all.
I have one more question for you.
And I'm trying to get you off the hook here as a South African white male.
Now, I have to admit,
it's also on the left.
I have to admit that it's hard for me to hear what you were saying, and I was feeling very defensive. And I do admit, though, that when you said, oh, about the Marxist kibbutzim, I like half smiled and said, oh, isn't that interesting? They were Stalinists. Sort of proving your point.
I know. That, look, you know, I had it too, like, a kind of a soft spot.
It was like, oh, isn't it interesting? It was more like a historical curiosity rather than, hey, wait a minute, in the 50s, the kibbutzim was supporting this terrible dictator.
Yeah.
You know.
And I found this great quote, which I included in the book, from Arik Sharon.
Yeah.
In the 90s, during the Oslo process, Sharon said, just as the Israeli left was infatuated with Stalin, today they're infatuated with Arafat. Now the comparison is obviously it's rhetorical. If one were to analyze it a little more in depth, the Israeli left didn't idolize Arafat the way they did Stalin, and not all of the Israeli left idolized Stalin. That's very important to say as well. The Ben Gurion Social Democratic left was anti-Stalin, mm-hmm. but a majority of the kibbutz movement was pro-Stalin, and there was something in the tendency of part of the Israeli left that didn't know that confused enemies for friends, and that saw in Stalin this messianic figure at a time when Stalin was planning the murder, the mass murder, of Soviet Jews. The death of Stalin saved probably saved hundreds of thousands of Soviet Jews from mass deportation to Siberia, which Stalin was planning after the Doctor's Plot. The Doctor's Plot was the contrived Stalinist accusation against a group of Jewish doctors who were allegedly trying to poison him, and that was going to be the trigger for the mass deportation of Soviet Jews. And so Stalin dying on Purim, or Erev Purim, I forget which it is seen by Marxists in the state of Israel and by Marxist Jews in America as this terrible loss. And that's the piece of it that we need to unpack.
The last question I have for you, and then I wanted to put it over to the students, and then one or two students who I know have questions for asking you, is in two interviews you spoke about this as being a Hebrew book written in English. And I would have imagined this book as having been written in Hebrew and translated into English. Instead, we have the opposite happening. It's being translated into Hebrew. Now, is that correct?
It's being translated.
I'm interested in how your Americanness helped, how it may have hurt, what it felt like to be, you know, however many years one can spend here, one still remains an Anglo-Saxon, how that helped or hurt the writing of this book, and then I'm happy to turn it over to students for questions or comments.
Well, Arik Achmon, who I mentioned earlier, was the guy who planned the crossing of the Suez Canal and was the first privatizer of a government company. When I first came to him and told him I wanted to do this book, and he said, how can you possibly write this story? Ata yeled chutz. And a yeled chutz, which literally means an external child, is a very specific term in the kibbutz lexicon. A yeled chutz was a child who did not have parents on the kibbutz, but was sent to the kibbutz either because they were orphans or because their parents were unable to raise them, and the state would send kids to the kibbutz. And depending on the kibbutz, these children were either absorbed into general society or not so absorbed. And Arik was saying to me that I'm a yeled chutz and I can never really understand the story. And I said to him, you're right, I am a yeled chutz, but it's only a yeled chutz who can watch you and know you better than you know yourselves. Because what you kibbutznikim never understood about the Yaldei Chutz is that we were spies among you. We are watching you. We're trying to learn the ways of the natives in order to figure out what kind of a society it is that we have fallen into. And so I feel that in one way he was right. This book took me far too long to write, and one of the reasons was because I was a yeled chutz. And I really had to learn. I had to learn a whole language. I had to learn the kibbutz world, and I didn't know the kibbutz culture. It's a world unto itself. I had to learn the settler world, B'nai Akiva, the religious Zionist movement, which I didn't know either. And I had to learn the paratroopers. I had to learn the wars. I mean, there were so many pieces of this story that have their own internal codes, and it took me years to learn. And so, in that sense, I was hampered. But what helped me in being, I think, a yeled chutz was that my goal in writing this book was to create a unified Israeli narrative about what happened to us as a result of 67. And I say an Israeli narrative because between 48 and 67, we have, as a people, a more or less consensus narrative about what the state was and what it meant. From 67 onward, the consensus narrative breaks down. And what we have instead is a right-wing narrative and a left-wing narrative. The right-wing narrative celebrates the 67 war as the greatest moment in Israel's history, an unqualified blessing. And the left-wing narrative sees the Six-Day War as the greatest curse in Israel's history. So when you have one part of the Israeli public seeing the same event as a blessing and the other as a curse, then you really are on your way to a very serious schism. And what I wanted to do in this book was, in a sense, braid together the left and the right back into the same story. And the way that the book works is it goes in and out of left-wing and right-wing characters. And when you are with a left-wing character, the book is left-wing. The consciousness of the book is left-wing. When you're with a right-wing character, the consciousness abruptly shifts, and the point of view of the book is right-wing. And it goes back and forth through the entire book. And the point of that is to try to create an integrated story about what happened to us as a result of 67. And that's something that I suspect only a Yelet Chutz could do, because I came to this story open. I had my ideas and I had my personal history, but I really wanted to understand, what is this place? And you and I came at the same time, more or less, at a really hard time for Israel. It was the beginning of the first Lebanon War, 400% inflation. The country was so divided that people were literally shouting at each other on the streets. Let the Sabra and Shatila massacre, the Lebanon War, which turned into a disaster, the settlement movement really taking off, 82, 83. And it was really a difficult moment. And so I wanted to just learn. I wanted to get my sense of, well, who's right here? And I really tried to open myself to left and right. And in the end, what I realized, you know, I asked myself for many years, what is the voice of this book? And I didn't hear it. And it was maddening for me as a writer. Now, every book has to have a voice. And I did not hear the voice. All I heard was a cacophony of voices. I heard left and right arguing with each other all the time. And one day, I just realized that's the voice of the book. And that really is my voice. It's my Israeli voice, because left and right have been arguing inside of me for 30 years since I became an Israeli. And that is, I think that's a result of being an immigrant, of going through that absorption process, which is not only being absorbed into Israel, but absorbing Israel into your being. And I really try to absorb the opposing pieces of Israel as much as possible into my evolving Israeliness. And that's, I think, a result of being an American, of coming with an American mentality. You know, I think that this is such a difficult place and such a relentless, you know, it's such a relentless pressure cooker, that coming from the Jewish experience, which is the exact opposite of that, coming from the American Jewish experience, and then taking this on, I wanted to retain something of my Americanness, and something of that ability to kind of step back and be a little more nuanced than people who've grown up in this pressure cooker are able to be. So I found my Americanness as a gift in this process.
Thank you very much. We have very, very little time, unfortunately, but for one or two questions. Melanie, do you want me to ask a question, or will you want me to ask it? So, and we'll take a few questions. There was a question from a student who said, what do you see as a positive lesson from your extremist time? What do you think attracts people to extremist groups? We're going to have to take a few questions, if that's all right. I'll write them down.
Sure.
There was also a question about the comparison between your book and Ari Shavit's My Promised Land, which is another bestseller at the moment, more written from the left, but also trying to present a nuanced Israel. Maybe we'll take two more questions for Yossi, and then you'll try and ask them all together. Mm-hmm. Yes, Sydney. Okay, and maybe one more question. Yes, Aaron.
What do you think it is about utopian dreams that we struggle to distance ourselves from the ones that we've accepted? And what is it about our own naivete that's difficult for us to challenge?
Okay, so I'll just repeat the questions.
This is impossible.
These are each a seminar. Each one is a seminar. And each one is a seminar.
How much time do we have?
10 minutes, say. Can we go 5 minutes over? We'll go 5 minutes over. The question is, positive lessons from your extremist time. What attracts people to extremism? What can we do to battle this? I mean, that'll only take a minute. What is the left and the right? You spoke about them as hegemonies. What is it that makes us so hard to give up our utopian dreams? And how do you see your book?
Was that your question? What makes it so hard to give up our utopian dreams?
And what is it about? And comparisons, I mean, between your book and Ari Shavit's book, they're probably at Barnes & Noble's both next to each other at the moment.
Oh, well, let me start with Ari's book, which I have not read. So I'll just make that short and easy. It was very funny, really, traveling through Jewish America in these last months with that question being asked at every stop. And so I can only say that Ari, who I don't know but admire very much as a commentator, is one of the more thoughtful Israeli commentators. It was very interesting, I'll use a very neutral term, to find my book not the only Israeli book in the field. And if this were here, that would not be a problem because we have lots of books. That's what we publish here, books about Israel. In America, it was interesting to see. The big question was, could the American reading public sustain two books on Israel at the same time? And without going into comparisons one way or another, I think the answer is yes. So that's good news for both of us. In terms of the extremist, what was your question? The extremist, growing up as an extremist, and why, what is the extremist temptation? I think the extremist temptation is very similar to the utopian temptation, and the root of those temptations in a way are the same, which is it is a deep and noble sense that this world is corrupt, and that there's something that the extremist or the utopian sensibility refuses to accept this world as it is. And the solutions that I would say the immature solutions that are offered tend often, the quote that you raised earlier, tend often to make reality worse. If you think of Europe's experiences in the 20th century with utopian movements, and communism and Nazism, both, each in its way, were utopian solutions. So the extremist temptation, though, is, I see, and actually I don't know how to do this in a minute, but the nihilist, the political extremist, and the religious mystic all begin at the same place. And that same place is that this world is unbearable. And they refuse to accept a normal, conventional life as an option. And to simply find your slot in this unbearable world is something that's rejected by the political extremist, the cultural nihilist, and the religious mystic. Where each one takes their solutions is a very different story. So, but the root source of that, you know, the Kabbalists always speak of the root source. What is the root? And the root, I think, of all three of those impulses is in a certain clarity about the unbearable nature of this world. So And that, I think, would partly answer your question, I hope, as well, about why it's so hard to give, why, the same reason it's so hard to give up our naivete and our utopian longings is the same reason it's so hard to give up our those of us who pass through extremist political movements, because it's so seductive, and it's you feel like you've been inducted into a secret society that knows the truth, and that's true for all extremist movements. So what else?
And the left and the right.
Yeah, that's such an important question. Look, in there's a mainstream left and a mainstream right in Israel, and then there's a hardcore, there's a pragmatic left and a pragmatic right, then there's an ideological left and an ideological right. Let's talk about today. The pragmatic left and the pragmatic right are, to my mind, for all practical purposes, the left and the right of the center. And it's a question of nuance, of emphasis. Are you more afraid of a Palestinian state, or are you more afraid of the absence of a Palestinian state? So the left of center would agree with the right of center that we are taking extreme risks in creating a Palestinian state, but that the risk of not creating a Palestinian state to Israel is worse. The right of center would agree with the left of center that the absence of a Palestinian state and the ongoing occupation is a tremendous risk for Israel. But at this moment, looking around the region and looking at the state of the Palestinian national movement being divided between Hamas and Fatah, etc., creating a Palestinian state under these circumstances is more of a risk than not creating a Palestinian state. So that's how I see the center. It's a question, it's an argument among Israelis who agree with the basic premises about what are the options facing Israel, and it's more of a tactical question. Then you have the ideological right and the ideological left. The ideological right are the settlers and their supporters. I would estimate their strength to be 20-25% of Israeli society. The settlers themselves are about 3%, but their infrastructure of support is wider. But still, quite a minority compared to what their support was in the 70s and the 80s in this country, when I would say probably a majority of Israelis supported the settlers. And that ideological position rejects nuance. The left doesn't have a case at all. The only fear that they acknowledge is the only danger they acknowledge is the danger of a Palestinian state, not the danger of the absence of a Palestinian state. And the ideological left, which is much, much smaller, it was a significant part of the population in the 90s. Today, the Israeli left is the hardcore ideological Haaretz, Meretz left. Well, one can look at the Knesset and see what remains of the ideological left. And maybe the last point that I'll mention in terms of the left and the right is that the Israeli political map used to be very clearly defined between the hard left and the hard right, the ideological left and the ideological right. We were really divided, and the center was nebulous, and little parties like the Third Way or Meimad came and went and had very, very little support. The ideological right began to lose the trust of the Israeli public during the First Intifada. That was the moment in the late 80s and early 90s when a majority of Israelis realized that the occupation is a disaster. And the ideological left lost its hold on the Israeli public, or much of the Israeli public, during the Second Intifada, when Israelis realized that just as the right had been wrong about the occupation, the left had been wrong about the peace. And so most Israelis today agree with the left about the occupation and agree with the right about peace. That's where most Israelis are today. And that brings us full circle to, I guess, where we began. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
Not
very
necessarily
much.
A cheery place to end, but certainly thought-provoking. And Yossi, you said that the Arik Achmon set you yelled chutz. I think you know that at Pardes you will always be an Ishpanim. We're always very, very happy to have you.
Thank
Look
you.
Forward to learning from you and challenging you and
for
learning
much,
all
David.
About you. Thank you very much.
Darabha.
Thank you.
If anyone wants books, they can.
Oh, yes. Books are on sale. So, 70 shekels for entering the Garden of Eden or entrance to the Garden of Eden, 140 shekels for. Like dreamers, there's no ideological thing. It's not like cheaper to dream than more expensive to dream than to make yourself the way to heaven. But they are on sale over here, and you'll be happy to sign. And Minchai is legal, of course.